and welcome to Worlds Apart. A week into Operation Epic Fury, it does seem to be living up to its title, although perhaps not in the way intended. The expanding geography of the strikes and skyrocketing energy prices have put many American allies in a bind between bad and worse, unable to move either way. Where is this war taking the already shattered global system? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Pietro Shakarian, a historian and lecturer at the American University of Armenia in Yerevan. Professor Shakarian, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Oksana, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Now, I know that a few days before the attack, you said in another interview that we are at the point of no return. Strikes could begin at any moment. What made you reach that conclusion back then, that it was a real thing and not yet another episode of showmanship?
Well, because there was so much buildup in the Persian Gulf. I mean, they were ready to go, as Trump said, locked and loaded. So it seemed to me like the war was impending. In the meantime, there were negotiations. In the meantime, I had hope that maybe something might come out of it, but given the legacy of what we saw in June, the so-called 12-day war, I was also thinking in the back of my mind that actually this might be like a ruse. This might be kind of like, you know, a fake kind of a thing. And also that also, by the way, is applicable to Russia because we saw what happened with the Minsk situation there. You know, I mean, where you had Merkel and Hollande basically admitting that this kind of Minsk was like a ruse. And we saw the same thing happen with Iran in June, and I was afraid the same thing might happen now. And unfortunately, it seems that was the case.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We almost a week into the strikes, and the further it goes, the more pointless and I guess dangerous it seems to be, dragging more and more countries in. What do you think was the initial goal of this attack, and has it changed in any way over the last week?
Well, I think the initial goal was a quick strike to take out, the supreme leader of Iran, Khamenei. But I think that was a horrible miscalculation on the part of the U.S. and on the part of Mr. Trump. He thought, I can do like regime change on the cheap, take him out, you know. But this, I don't know who his Iran advisors were, but Iran as a country has a very, very complex system. So even if you take out the supreme leader, that's not going to be enough to implement this regime change. And so that's pretty much, you know, I think that how he ended up in something like this. And I think also, you know, Trump is facing some domestic problems at home, and he thought maybe this, you know, kind of quick war would boost his ratings.
Now, if we compare these three belligerents, Israel and the United States do seem to have, outwardly at least, a superior capacity to inflict pain. But it seems that Iran may have the edge in terms of absorbing the pain. Who do you think is better prepared at this point to face a longer conflict?
I think Iran is better prepared to face a longer conflict. First of all, because right now, yes, they're firing their missiles. You know, not only in terms of Israel, but also as we saw in the Gulf with all these Gulf, these Arab states in the Persian Gulf. Right, this is the big thing. But and also the U.S. military infrastructure in the region. But I think also they're just using up their old stock of weapons. They're going to be moving to the more advanced, the more sophisticated weapons, coming soon. And also you have to think, Oksana, that Iran is an ancient country, an ancient civilization. It's a country where there's an intense nationalism. There's also, again, this kind of historical kind of passionate devotion to kind of Shia Islam. And they're not going to go down without a fight. I mean, and then also you have to think the size of this country, Oksana. This is about 100 million people. It's with an area the size of Western Europe. You know, some might even say like Mongolia. It's a huge country by area, huge country by population. It's not Iraq.
I'm hearing Russian analysts at least saying that because of the availability of these high-precision weapons, the risk of war may be perceived as like a smaller, at least in Washington. Do you think Israel and the United States have actually taken into account not only the hidden, but pretty obvious risks of launching something like this?
No, because I think that, Oksana, I think that there's a lot of hubris involved. I think that they've really thought, you know, we're so superior, we can easily defeat these people, and that will be that. You know, even you have to think that the consideration that they thought that by just taking out the supreme leader, the whole system would fall apart, that means they're badly informed, horribly informed on the actual dynamics within the society of Iran, inside the country. So I think there's a lot of hubris at play. There's a lot of miscalculation going on about this. And I think actually Iran is the country in this case that has the strength to absorb the blow. You also have to think, too, that, you know, Iran, it's a government that is frames itself as a revolutionary government. And so this IRGC was meant to be like a check on the Iranian military. There are many different layers in a country like this. And so a single strike is not going to take it out. It's not going to take it out. And if they thought that we could easily overwhelm them, they don't even have Oksana. they claim that they have this domination over the Iranian skies, but they don't have that domination. Maybe in some parts of Iran, yes, but not over the entire country.
Absolutely. And I don't think they have domination even over their own skies. What do you make of this ever-expanding geography of strikes and the conflicting reports of who fired at whom? Is it still sort of a two-front conflict, or is it a bit more murky than that?
Well, it depends on what we're looking at here. I mean, there's a lot of murkiness going on. So, for instance, you saw that there was this incident with Kuwait where it was claimed that Kuwait accidentally shot down these American fighter jets. But, you know, most likely, I think, in my assessment, these were more likely shot down by Iranian, forces. I mean, this is my kind of view on that. Similarly, I mean, there's been, as you know, I mean, I can tell you here from Yerevan, there has been a lot of kind of controversy over this issue of this strike on the airports in Nakhichevan, which is an exclave of the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. And, Azerbaijan was quick to rush to the conclusion, Mr. Aliyev was quick to rush to the conclusion, that this was Iran that launched this drone at the Nakhichevan airport. But the Iranian side said, no, we did not, as a matter of fact, launch this drone toward you. We actually want to avoid expanding the geography of this conflict. This seems to us, I mean, from the Iranian point of view, this is what they were saying. They were saying, it seems to us that, that this was like a false flag operation by Israel to bring in more countries into the conflict. So that's kind of how I see it. I mean, even now, even here in Armenia, there are reports in the southern Sunni province of a firefight, I guess, between Iranian and Azerbaijani forces. Now that has kind of cooled down, as we can see. But still, it's a reflection of the fact that there's enormous risk of this conflict, you know, spreading very easily. And also, I just want to add one more thing to this. This also kind of flies in the face of Trump's kind of grand plans to establish peace in the South Caucasus, you know, between Armenia and Azerbaijan and all that. So all of this is kind of unraveling his whole record, Mr. Trump's record of trying to be a peace president.
Speaking about Azerbaijan, the Iranians made it pretty clear that they consider nations that allow their airspace or military bases to be used by either the Americans or the Israelis to be complicit in the attack on Iran. And Azerbaijan, as well as Georgia, the examples of the countries that do provide their airspace to the Americans. It's also not a geopolitical secret that Azerbaijan in recent years has allied itself with Israel and that it may have something to gain economically from the Iranian defeat. How do you think it's likely to position itself in this conflict? I'm talking specifically about Azerbaijan.
Well, Azerbaijan in this conflict, there were very credible reports that emerged that if Washington was successful, Washington and Tel Aviv were successful in fragmenting Iran, because part of the idea was not necessarily regime change, but really kind of regime removal. The idea that really to fragment Iran and turn it into like a Syrian scenario, you know. And the idea would be if that happened, Aliyev would get involved in northern Iran, which is the Iranian Azerbaijan. So there are a lot of Azerbaijanis in northern Iran. But here's the thing. Iranian Azerbaijanis are very integrated into the Iranian society. Just look at the Supreme Leader, Mr. Khamenei. Look at Mr. Pezeshkian. They're very, very integrated into the fabric of Iranian life. Go back to the history with the Safavid dynasty. It came from Iranian Azerbaijan. So the whole history, I mean, the whole integration of Azerbaijan with Iran, it's not likely, you know, to see a serious fragmentation. But still, this is, I guess, the calculation from Baku, that if we ally ourselves with Israel, we can have some kind of political dividends.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say before that Russia and China will not allow Iran to disintegrate completely, or in fact, perhaps advance or approve of Azerbaijan's territorial claims. But for now, both Moscow and Beijing are watching very attentively from the sidelines. What do you think are their strategies at this point?
I think their strategy is to help Iran through kind of military technical cooperation and diplomacy, you know, but right now it's not for them necessarily to get involved directly. Right now, Iran, as we should understand, and this it corresponds, Oksana, with the philosophy of BRICS, with the philosophy of the idea of the rise of the rest, that Iran can handle itself. Iran can absorb these blows, as I was saying. So unless Iran is in super dire straits, unless it looks like the state is completely falling apart, Russia and China will provide assistance that is very, very pragmatic and careful assistance to ensure that something, a catastrophe like this does not happen. Because Iran, as a node in BRICS, is very important, connecting West Asia with Central Asia, with South Asia, with East Asia, with North Asia, with Russia, Eurasia. It's incredibly important. So that's how I see it. Mm-hmm. Russia and China will not abandon Iran, and they will support, you know, this effort toward a multipolar world, which, by the way, is inevitable.
Let me ask you specifically about Russia, because Moscow has a certain affinity for spheres of influence or sort of buffer zones, and it went to war with Ukraine because of that. But I'm not quite sure personally how it sees its safety perimeter at this point of time, especially in the South Caucasus, and which countries theoretically may fall under it. What do you think?
I think that for Russia, the having its main interest in the former Soviet states is having kind of a secure buffer of states that helps provide it with, you know, kind of a security, because ultimately that's why it's interested in having kind of good relations, really, with these countries. Now, it also respects their sovereignty. So Russia is not going to pursue a policy like what Trump did in Venezuela to go in and kidnap, I don't know, the president of Ukraine, or take Zelensky to Moscow or something like this. That is not their style. They respect the sovereignty of each former Soviet republic. And so it's up to them to make their choice on these matters. But at the same time, it is of fundamental importance for Russia to maintain positive relations with these countries, and also for these countries to look at the fact that they benefit a lot from a good relationship with Russia. So here in Yerevan, here in Armenia, Russia has a huge role in the Armenian economy. It's helping the Armenian economy quite a bit. So,
Professor Shakaran, let me stop you right there, because I do want to consider the Armenian angle in more details. But for now, let's take a very short break. We'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Deep State has its hands in everything. I was in the middle of it for decades. When I blew the whistle on CIA torture, the Deep State turned on me. They ruined my life, took away my rights, threw me in prison, but they didn't break me. I fought back, and I still do. I'm John Kiriakou. On my show, The Deep State, I take you behind the geopolitical moves, the color revolutions, behind the politics and the politicians. We shine a light on where the deep state is hiding.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Pietro Shakarian, a historian and lecturer at the American University of Armenia in Yerevan. Professor Shakarian, you're currently based in Armenia, which over the last couple of years has flirted quite openly with the West. Not the Ukrainian way, but still, I think it's fair to say that it has sought to capitalize on the conflict between Russia and the West, with the West being portrayed as both an example of good governance or better governance and higher geopolitical moral standards. Do you think this campaign against Iran, its conduct, its pretext, the way it was carried out, do you think it may instill some second thoughts in the Armenian leadership, or let's say the Armenian people?
I can't say about the government, because I think the government, the elites within the current Armenian government are living in certain illusions about the West. But I can say that the people are seeing this. They're seeing the reality of this disastrous war with Iran, because, like I said, they were sold this idea by the government that, you know, that this kind of trip corridor, right, this idea of kind of creating a kind of a corridor through Armenia's southern Sunni province that would be essentially controlled by private U.S. interests on the border with Iran, that somehow that would help Armenian security. But as we know, both Tehran and Moscow were not so crazy about this idea, and especially in the current environment where you see that there's war, and, you know, Mr. Pashinyan was trying to sell the Armenian public on the idea that, you know, Trump is a man of peace, that he will prevent war, that even he, together with Aliyev, even nominated Mr. Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, right? But that whole reputation of Trump, or the aspiration of Trump to be the peace person, is now the peace candidate, because that's what he ran on in the U.S., is now unraveling at breakneck speed in Iran, because he's destroying the country. There's also atrocities being committed, as we saw with the girls' school. And so now that whole reputation of Trump is coming apart. Right? Like the show is Worlds Apart. Well, Trump's reputation is coming apart. So that's, yeah.
Speaking about this project that you just mentioned, I know that you also wrote a lot about the recent visit by U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance to the South Caucasus, during which he indeed promoted this idea of Armenia providing or leasing part of its own southern province on the border with Iran to the Americans, which logistically, and I would say geopolitically, would alter the map of South Caucasus. Do you think that project is still on the cards? And if so, why do you think Russia is so quiet about it? Because I cannot imagine the Russians, you know, being okay with that, even if it was carried out by private companies.
Well, the Russians are not okay with it at all, Oksana, but the Russians are... They play their cards very, very smartly, right? It's like a poker game, and they have a poker face, and they will not show all their cards and show everything that they do and how they will react to this immediately. They will be extraordinarily, extraordinarily cautious on this project, because they also understand, you know, that Armenia and Russia have a very deep historical friendship. There's a friendship between the Russian and Armenian people, and the Armenian people know, above all else, their own security interests. So Moscow is also confident that the Armenian people will eventually decide what is ultimately in their interests, and this trip, this so-called Trump corridor, is not in their interests. And even Mr. Vance, he endorsed Mr. Pashinyan, but that backfired, because Mr. Vance went to the Armenian Genocide Memorial. He tweeted about it, or put it on X, and then he removed that tweet. And people in Armenia saw that. People in the Armenian diaspora saw that. So the whole endorsement of Vance, toward Pashinyan, that backfired completely.
You know, my own intuition is that the Russians concluded that it's counterproductive to argue publicly with Trump, and that perhaps they are counting on this initiative being stillborn. But it does raise a question under which circumstances you think Russia may use force to either push the Americans out of the Caucasus, or perhaps lend some help to Iran.
Well, I think that we also have to look at the strategic partnership treaty that was concluded between Moscow and Tehran, where it says unambiguously, Oksana, that you know, Russia and Iran will not tolerate at all the presence of third parties in this region. They will not accept that. And I think, frankly, what is going to end up happening is they are not going to tolerate. And I can't say how. I don't have all the intelligence, right? I'm not on the inside, right? I wouldn't know everything about what their plans are. But I can tell you, they will not tolerate it, and this will not be allowed to pass, mm-hmm. that you have an American base in Mekri, in southern Armenia, overlooking Iran. It will not happen. I can assure you of that.
Absolutely. I mean, we mentioned the Ukrainian war already. Let me ask you a question about that, because I'm sure the war is likely to continue, but do you think the framing of it as this democratic struggle against barbarism will remain after everything that was done to Iran? Even in Europe, for example, do you think they will continue portraying what is happening in Ukraine as this great enlightened struggle for the better future?
I think, Oksana, Europe is politically, I mean, the European elites, that is, they are politically bankrupt. They are talking about democracy and human rights and whatnot, but you see that they have endorsed, most of them anyway. Spain is a notable exception. You have also Ireland, you know, but most of those European elites, they are on board with this war in Iran. This blatant act of aggression, this blatant violation of international law, and so their entire credibility has completely unraveled, right? First and foremost, you know, one of the first people to write about, you know, cheering Trump on was Kaya Kallas. You know, she was jumping on the bandwagon of war. And the idea was, of course, according to them, that this was a war of liberation, that we were going to liberate the Iranian people, bring back, that we're bringing into power the Shah's son, who, of course, is not democratic at all. But I think the whole Ukrainian, situation, the reality of it is becoming more and more apparent to the European people that this is a war that is disproportionately negatively affecting the people of Europe. And it should actually wake up the Europeans to the fact that they should not be so reliant on the United States for everything, that maybe Europe should pursue its own path. In this world of multipolarity, maybe it's time for the Europeans to kind of consider new alternatives to how they relate to the rest of the world, yeah.
And maybe the war in Iran can provide an additional wake-up call, because given the precarious situation around the Strait of Hormuz and the calamity on the global energy markets, we are at the point where European leadership, theoretically at least, could do some math, reflect, and perhaps walk back on some of its earlier decisions to stop buying Russian energy sources completely. Do you think it's likely to happen?
Unfortunately, no, because those European elites, they are tied at the hip with Washington. You saw Mr. Merz. I mean, you saw him sitting there with Trump. They're not going to, unfortunately, they're not going to change their tune. There are some brave voices, like I said, like in Spain and Ireland, who already, you know, they see what the reality is. But I can't say the same for Mr. Macron or Mr. Starmer or, you know, Mr. Merz. They're just, you know, There has been. If you are a voter in a European country, you don't want a representative who is a follower. You want a leader of that country, like it used to be in Europe, right? In the post-war period, where you had real leaders like Charles de Gaulle. Nowadays, what do you have? You have just followers. You don't have leaders. Like, I can say this, when we mentioned about Iran now, look back at the Iraq War, Oksana. Look at the fact that you had Mr. Chirac and Mr. Schroeder bravely dissenting on the American decision to invade Iraq. And now, where is that bravery today? Maybe it's time for it to come back.
Well, maybe. But I mean, ultimately, what makes good leaders is the connection with reality in a very material sense. And to some extent, I mean, energy sources is, it belongs to the stubborn reality. Merz may not have to think about how to heat his home, but, you know, there are a lot of German businesses that will have to do that somehow. And speaking again about the energy sources, the Russian leadership has already hinted that Moscow, on its own initiative, may reroute the remaining energy exports away from the European Union towards friendlier markets, for example, China, which until recently used to receive about 80% of Iranian oil exports, and in 2025, around 80% of the Venezuelan oil exports. Do you see that as situational, or do you think perhaps that's a sign of a much larger process of, you know, global regrouping that's already underway.
Well, Oksana, it depends on the position of the Europeans. If the Europeans want to come back and work with the Russians again, Moscow will, of course, be happy, and it would be easier for everybody if they can use the infrastructure that's already there. But the longer the Europeans decide to kind of, you know, go against, you know, reality, then what can I say? Then Russia will have no choice to then, you know, do, you know, that kind of redirecting. It won't have another option. But, you know, right now, the door is always open. If the Europeans want to come back and cooperate with Russia, Russia has no problem with that. And it's just up to them.
Well, I'm actually no longer sure about that. I mean, seeing Putin talk about that in sort of possible terms, the decision has not yet been taken. But I think he is sort of pushing Russia towards more secure partners, because a number of Russian analysts have already said that we are indeed at a pivotal moment, because never before have we witnessed such a brazen attack on a large UN member state. Iran, as you said, is not Iraq, it's not Libya, it's not Syria, it's a much bigger, better structured, and also, you know, a country with lots of regional influence. And it's not that the international law was much respected before, but this attack does change the perception of what's acceptable, what's possible in international relations. It makes diplomacy also not just irrelevant, but very dangerous. So I guess my last question to you is, where do you think it's all heading?
I think that this war will fundamentally alter the international system, Oksana. I can't see it that after this war, nothing will be the same. It's going to, I think, hurt the global position of the United States. That's why, actually, by the way, you saw a lot of dissent coming out of the American Pentagon, right? There were these leaks that came out in the American press from the American Pentagon about this war, that they understood, many people in the American elite understood, this war was not going to end well for the United States and its global position. So we're going to, the whole process of multipolarity, which had been slowly and steadily growing, it's now going to be moving at a much faster breakneck speed after this war, right? This is one of those fundamental changes, like the Ukraine war fundamentally changed things. It fundamentally made Russia, in many respects, as you alluded, realize that it cannot depend on the West. It has to, you know, create its own independence. Actually, in many ways, the sanctions allowed Russia to find its own kind of independent path. So that's, I think, where this war will lead us. It's going to actually diminish the American power. I think this was maybe a desperate bid to stop, in addition, of course, to the role of Israel and its own interests. But I think this was also a desperate bid to stop the integration of BRICS. And I think actually, it, rather than that outcome, it will lead to an acceleration and a deepening of multipolarity. Because this process is not something you can stop at all.
Okay. Well, Professor Shekaran, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Oksana, and happy Women's Day.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you next week on Worlds Apart.